Welcome to Season 5 of The Supporting Cast. This is Eli Goldsmith. In this episode, we welcome our very first return guest to the series, Dr. Mark Krieger, Surgeon-in-Chief at Children's Hospital Los Angeles. Back in March of 2022, Dr. Krieger joined us to speak about kids and COVID-19. Now, 2 years later, he addresses a different kind of global health crisis, relating to adolescent mental health. And I should clarify that while Harvard-Westlake has been impacted greatly by this crisis, this conversation is less about a specific school community and more about what is happening within a generation of adolescents. Dr. Krieger and I discuss issues relating to the pandemic, to social media use, to destigmatization around asking for help, to the role of parents and parenting, to the lessons of neuroscience. I should mention that Dr. Krieger is a practicing pediatric neurosurgeon. And finally, how schools can be part of the solution by creating communities of connectivity and belonging. With appreciation to Dr. Krieger for joining the series a second time, and to you for joining me for a fifth season of The Supporting Cast. Dr. Mark Krieger, welcome back to The Supporting Cast.
Thanks. It's really a pleasure to be here and engage in another dialogue with you. Thanks for the invitation.
For me too. And at first, you know, we started off then, and we're starting off now with grounding ourselves in the present. Before we get to kind of larger issues related to adolescent health, first, how are you, Dr. Krieger? How are you? How's your family?
Oh, thanks for asking. We're all doing well. So it's a little bit of a crazy time for us. The stuff at the hospital is always busy. And so I did 3 brain surgeries yesterday and then, you know, shapeshift into being a dad when I get home. My wife, Christy, is in the middle of her Oscar season. And my son is a very engaged 9th grader and mostly loving that.
Great. And let me add, I think the last time we spoke, which is a number of years ago, your wife was also nominated for an Oscar for West Side Story. And then 3 years later, she's nominated again for Maestro.
Yeah. So I'm super proud of her. And I hope this doesn't sound like bragging, but this is actually her 5th Oscar nomination. And She's now been nominated 3 years in a row, which is kind of stratospheric levels. And she would never be the one to tell that because she's sort of very humble and doesn't necessarily love talking about those things. But it's really a great thing for her and a true testament to all of her hard work over the years.
And I should mention, Christy is a producer, Steven Spielberg's producing partner, and then now Bradley Cooper's producing partner on this new film.
Yes, absolutely. These have all been voyages.
Yeah, I also find it interesting that, you know, you mentioned you performed 3 pediatric brain surgeries yesterday, and yet your wife is often the most celebrated person, even in your own home, Mark. I don't know how that works.
Well, she's a better person than I am and a lot more fun to be around. I think we both feel that we get appropriate levels of respect for what we do. But, you know, when you come home, you're just a family. And I think, you know,
that's right.
Somebody's got to take out the trash.
Turning to a more serious note, today's topic is on the adolescent mental health crisis that I think people listening and so many of us are aware is occurring within our community, within our country, within our world. Before we begin, you know, a few years ago, we talked about kids and COVID. You are the surgeon in chief at Children's Hospital Los Angeles. You were not an epidemiologist, yet we had, I think, a really wonderful conversation, very informative conversation about kids and COVID. You're also not an adolescent mental health expert by training, despite your familiarity with the adolescent brain. And so just wanted to mention off the top that the perspective that you have is one of a leader of one of the major children's hospitals in our country. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's fair to say. I mean, look, I'm super proud of my work at Children's Hospital. It's a great place. I mean, we treat kids throughout all of Los Angeles, regardless of ability to pay. We have huge volumes of patients. And, you know, I'm fortunate enough that I treat kids for their whole life. So I have patients now that I treated when they were infants or premature infants 20 years ago, and I get to know their families. So, and I see them for 20 years. So I get to really see what happens over the course of time. But, you know, I'd also mention that Children's Hospital has 10,000 employees, and, you know, I lead a department of 150 surgeons. And so all these trends that affect society help us from those levels also. And so we've been dealing with many of these same issues in microcosm that society is dealing with as well, both in terms of our patients, but also in terms of our workforce. And being able to support our workforce is super important as well.
So when you think about the adolescent mental health crisis in America and in the world, from your perspective and from where you sit, what are the statistics and trends that jump to mind as the most profound indicators of this crisis?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I get a little cringy when people mention it as a mental health crisis, and it clearly is. You want to use terms that don't sort of increase everybody's anxiety about the issue, but lead to constructive steps. And so I think talking about an adolescent mental health crisis was important just to focus everybody on the problem, but now we need to figure out a more constructive way of dealing with it. You know, these epidemiologic statistics take a long time to compile. And so most of the things that we have, most of the longitudinal data that we have is actually from before COVID, but it's really kind of alarming. So if you look at 10 years prior to the pandemic, if you look at CDC data, over those 10 years, there was a 40% increase in mental health issues among adolescents over that time period. You know, when we talk about mental health issues, we're talking about feelings of sadness and helplessness that are persistent, suicidal thoughts and behaviors. So much so that if you look at 2019, sort of the last year before the pandemic hit, almost 40% of adolescents who were screened said that they were so sad and hopeless that they couldn't even participate in normal activities at some point during the course of the year. And wow, this is an incredible number, right? And incredibly, one out of every five adolescents answered affirmatively to whether they had either seriously considered or attempted suicide in that year. So this was even before the pandemic hit. So it's really shocking numbers as to the pervasiveness and severity of this. And, you know, those numbers are even worse for reasons that we don't fully understand, but we could conjecture among girls and members of the LGBTQ plus communities, where those numbers are even much higher. So this was something that existed even before COVID hit and is really sort of shocking in its scope.
Yeah, I'm remembering, the last time we spoke a few years ago was still during the COVID-19 pandemic, and we were talking about these measures, social distancing and school closures, and at what point could we get kids back to school and how important that would be. It's hard not to think that that has been a contributor or even an accelerant of some of these issues. But as you point out, this started almost a decade before the pandemic, at least from the statistics that you cite. So why, in your mind, did these trends begin around that time? And if the pandemic wasn't a root cause, what was?
Yeah, I mean, so sort of two different questions, but, you know, why were these things getting worse? And I think it's a lot of things, right? I mean, I think I'll come back to social media in a second, because that may be the biggest part of it, but I don't want to start with that. But, you know, I mean, the world has become a little bit of a crazy place, right? I mean, there's a lot of political discord. It's all very, very public. You know, people are anxious about climate change. All of these societal factors are out there, and they cause anxiety and feelings of hopelessness amongst many people in the world, but those have been accelerating over time. And then you compound that with sort of the normal ups and downs of adolescent life, which has sort of become more focused on over time. You know, that makes things a lot worse. But there are other two things, right? And so one is social media, and I think we can come back to that in a little bit. But social media, I think, and its acceleration in this time period and acting as an accelerant, like putting gas on a fire, has been a big issue. But the other issue is, and I think you can't really discount it, has been the earlier onset of puberty among adolescents. And so that, over the last 20 years, has become much more early than it used to be. So much so, you know, puberty usually starts with girls first. Pubertal onset after age eight years of age, is no longer considered early. And for boys, it's soon after that. And that has really profound implications. You know, I'm a neurosurgeon, so I'm going to talk a little bit about brain stuff. But when you look at the early pubertal brain, things are changing in the brain that make them much more susceptible to anxiety and things of that sort. So scientifically speaking, there's an increased number of sort of the reward receptors, oxytocin and dopaminergic receptors in the brain right around that age at the start of puberty. And that means that kids at that age are looking for a reward. And the way the brain works is it's a lot of times it's social reward. So they're looking for social approval at an early age when this happens. So you have these brains that are advancing on an emotional and social and reward-based level, but the higher parts of the brain, the cognitive parts, the parts that are sort of there for reality testing and telling us, you know, how to control our emotions and how to function in the world, haven't developed yet. So you have this big mismatch of these different parts of the brain early on, and that's now happening much earlier than it used to happen, where we don't really have the full societal means of addressing it. And so you have kids who have these things happening to them that they don't fully understand, and we don't fully understand, and we're not really prepared for, and that affects it. And then I think, aside from this pubertal changes, that feeds right into the social media thing. So for all of these reasons and all these things that we're talking about, these kids are seeking social acceptance. And in the past, without social media, social acceptance was a relatively limited group of your friends, and it didn't have permanence to it. You might have said something silly and somebody smiled or made fun of you, but it ended. And now with social media, the audience is much larger and it's permanent. What you put in social media stays out there. And so you no longer have as much of a chance to make mistakes without implications or repercussions early on. And I think that that's a big thing. The other thing about social media is we see a very idealized view of ourselves, of other people and things out there. So people are really looking their best when they post something, and the celebrities are looking their best. And it sort of sets really high standards for kids to live up to. So I know I threw a lot of different things out there, and it's super complicated, but it's there.
The puberty information is really fascinating. I hadn't heard that before. Have they done studies on why kids are going through puberty earlier now? Is it the food that they're eating? Is it caffeine? Is it, what is it?
Yeah, everybody's got their bias to that, right? And they talk about hormones and additives and things like that. I haven't seen really good scientific evidence supporting any of those things. When you look at a trend that affects the world, really, because this is something happening throughout the world, I think probably good nutrition plays a large role. I'm not sure that it's something that's pathologic that kids are going through this earlier, but it definitely has mental health implications and societal implications that really need to be addressed and thought of.
And I think about the impulsivity of adolescence. There's a lot of talk about that. And if there is a disconnect between the parts of the brain that you describe, that if the reaction to some of the things they're going through is more impulsive than someone with a more mature brain might react, maybe that is telling as well.
So one of the things that I find really interesting is there's something called social networks use disorder. So this is a psychological diagnosis, primarily in adults. But, you know, when you read about these things, and this is something that's been well published, it talks about impulsivity, general executive functions, and inhibitory control. So this is in adults. So the people who have this social networks use disorder are impulsive. They don't have the higher level of control over what they're doing, and they don't know how to inhibit what they're doing. You know, so sort of like, you know, things that we see in a lot of things, addictions, gambling, substance abuse, it's what these kids' brains have from the very start. By definition, that's who they are. And that makes them more susceptible to overuse of social media.
The other point you made, you know, I hear about this a lot, that adolescents now are feeling down about the state of the world, the state of politics, of climate change. Does it also point to how we as a society try to address, you know, there is so much doom and gloom in how we talk about these issues. And it isn't as though, I think most people listening would think, these are issues we really need to address and improve. Should we be discussing them more optimistically about all the things we can do, not all the things we can't?
Yeah. I mean, I sure wish, right? Like, I would love there to be a political candidate who could galvanize people in a way about, in sort of the John F. Kennedy type of model. And that just doesn't exist out there. But I think you're onto something. And I think the point is that the more, and, you know, one of the biggest answers to all this is the more community and the more connectedness we have and the more common sense of common good that we have, the better off we are, and the more divisiveness, the worse we are. And that's what sort of creates a lot of the anxiety that's out there.
So back to the social media piece, you mentioned that there are disproportionate issues around mental health with girls, adolescent girls, and the LGBTQ+ community. Does that overlap with social media? Is social media have more of an effect with certain communities of adolescents than others?
I think certainly with girls, and I haven't seen any scientific studies about this, right? Because we're still sort of trying to sort this all out. But I think there's some data that girls are more sensitive to body image issues, right? I think, you know, I'm making that sound fancy, but I think that that's probably something that we would all acknowledge. And social media makes it worse. I mean, people are comparing themselves to an idealized sense of things, right? You know, like you think of the movie Barbie and all the messages from that, which, you know, a lot of them are wonderful, but you're putting something out there and that was just a doll. And now it's all over the place and people are seeing that all the time. So there's the physical idealization and trying to match up to a standard. But then there's all kinds of issues of shaming and bullying and differences that come up for different reasons. Those affect girls more than boys in a lot of different ways. Not that they don't affect boys too, but there just seems to be a more susceptibility to it.
And I will point out a plug for, we're not going to talk specifically about Harvard Westlake policies in this conversation, but we have banned cell phones at the middle school campus. That was part of a new plan this year that has had almost universal approval among parents, I will say.
Yeah. And I think that there was, I don't remember where I read it, but there was something where, and it might've been a Harvard Westlake student, but they wrote that they were grateful that their parents made them not sleep with their phone up until 12th grade and the benefit that that had to sort of help them regulate their impulsivity on it.
Yeah. At the same time, I want to kind of put the mirror back on parents a little bit too. You know, I'm a parent and I use social media, hopefully not to too much excess, but there are times I have a 2.5-year-old daughter who is the most delightful person I think I have ever met in my life. And occasionally we'll be playing and I'll get a work email and I will pick up my phone. And all of a sudden, 3 minutes later, I'm deep into something into my phone and not paying attention to, again, the most wonderful thing I've ever set eyes on. And these things are addictive for adults too.
Absolutely. You
know? And how do we handle it in ourselves? How do we handle that impulse in ourselves as models for our kids?
Yeah. And, you know, I'd have two answers to that, right? I mean, one is we all want to, you know, model best behavior, right? And that's super important. And so it's important to realize that we need to connect directly. And so I think it's important to set up time as a parent where you're having direct face-to-face conversations over dinner, over meals, on the weekends that don't involve social media. But the other thing I would say is the world is challenging and there's a lot of things going on. And I think it's one of those situations where, you know, the enemy of good is perfect. And I think we have to just do our best as parents. And when you're a parent, you're just balancing a lot of different things and you have to be able to balance it in the real world. And I think that's just a reality also.
So it's have a little grace with ourselves and understanding, but at the same time, try to, you know, maybe when I'm playing with my daughter, put the phone at the other side of the room or don't bring the phone to the dinner table, those types of rules.
Absolutely. Hard to do though.
Yeah, it is. So I guess my next question, now that we're talking about so many of the challenges that adolescents are having, what are some of the solutions? What are the things we can do, not just as a school, but all of us, to try to improve this situation?
You know, I think a lot of what we know now, and I really applaud the Harvard Westlake plan on mental health and wellness, and I think it addresses a lot of these issues, so I don't want to be redundant, but I think, for lack of a better word, I think the pandemic was a little bit of a test case, right? So we saw what happened when kids weren't going to school and didn't have the community of school. And so what was the result of that? You know, we saw a lot of increased reporting of people who experienced racism. In one of the CDC surveys, they found that 50% of Black children and adolescents experienced racism during the pandemic, and 60% of Asian students experienced racism during the pandemic, right? So they were disconnected from their normal communities, but online and out in the world without school support, and those trends increased. You know, there was a lot of stress of parents losing their jobs. 29% of parents of adolescents lost their jobs. And there was an increased risk of abuse. So 55% of adolescents reported emotional abuse at home during the pandemic.
Oh my gosh.
Crazy, yeah. Right? So why is this important? This is important because it emphasizes the importance of the school and it emphasizes the importance of community. So I think that that's the most important thing of all this. The school needs to be a safe space and a community where kids can feel protected, not subject to racism, not subject to emotional or physical abuse, and really feel that they're able to accomplish things and move things forward. The other thing is, you know, there's all this talk now about achievement culture, and obviously a place like Harvard Westlake has to address that a lot. And there was this really great book that came out, Never Enough, by Jennifer Wallace, that talked about, you know, when achievement culture becomes toxic. And I think there are two sides to that. I mean, obviously, nobody would say that achievement culture should be toxic, but kids need a purpose. And I think for them to want to achieve, as long as it's done in a healthy fashion and as part of an integration into a community, I don't think that that's a bad thing. So, you know, from my point of view, to sum up, I mean, schools provide community, they provide a safe place, they provide programs that help people feel connected, and they can provide a sense of achievement that could bolster self-esteem, as long as the message isn't, we only care about your achievements. You know, we care about you as a person, not just your achievements. And I think that that's super important as we go through it. The other thing is, you know, schools, there's a whole big school of thought that kids need to be screened for anxiety and depression and suicidal behavior. It's really hard for schools to do that screening. Like, I think that's probably a pediatrician's place. You know, I think that when we have these school forms, you know, that the pediatricians have to fill out and they say, you know, there are no issues or the heart is okay, it should probably also ask for screening for all these things. The school can't screen everybody for that, but they definitely need every teacher to be trained and aware and have the appropriate resources to address these things where appropriate.
On the screenings front, I've actually heard recently of fledgling AI companies that are trying to scan adolescent faces for signs of depression or suicidal ideology. Have you heard anything like that? Is there anything there?
I've heard stuff like that. And, you know, it almost goes back to, in my field, there's like phrenology, where you used to like feel the lumps on somebody's brain and see if they were smart or if they had particular skills and stuff. And it's a little bit hard. I mean, ultimately, I think these things will be really great. But right now, I'm just a little worried that there could be more harm than good in poorly applied screening tests. One of the main initiatives to try to help with the mental health issues is to do screening. I just think it's really hard for a school to do that. And I think it belongs probably in the pediatrician's office, which has been a big push by the American Academy of Pediatricians.
What about this notion of destigmatization, which I think is so important? We talk about it a lot at Harvard West, like changing our terminology from not if you need help, here's the resources, but when you need help. You know, that's been an important shift in how we think about things. That said, I've been reading about this notion of something called prevalence inflation, which is the more and more we talk about anxiety in adolescence, the more adolescents might think that any sign of anxiousness or anxiety or nervousness is a sign of a larger problem. Whereas being anxious about a test, an upcoming game, an upcoming performance, I would imagine is somewhat typical in an adolescent, and actually overcoming that anxiety, overcoming and accomplishing something difficult, may be beneficial to an adolescent's mental health. How do you think about squaring these two seemingly disparate ideas?
Yeah, I think it's really a tricky question and a super important one, right? So we definitely want to be able to identify people who are at risk. And we want to make sure that if they're at risk, they have the appropriate access to resources to be able to, you know, do that. We want to be able to identify those kids. We want to be able to support them. And I think, you know, talking about wellness is a much better term to use, you know, overall wellness, right? Like, we do yoga, not because I don't do yoga, but we do yoga because, you know, we want to make our bodies healthier, not because we're addressing a specific medical problem. So I think overall wellness is a good way to look at it. I think having an eye out for people who are at risk is an important thing. There's a huge limited availability of mental health professionals in the world. And so most people who even identify themselves as needing mental health care aren't able to get it. And so I think providing those resources is really, really good. And then the last thing is, I think destigmatizing is important. I'm not so worried about the fact that if we talk about it, we're going to make it worse. So I do some work for the NFL on concussions. And so, you know, there's obviously been a lot of attention to that. And we were worried that when we called attention to concussions, everybody would say that they had a concussion and nobody would be able to play it. But we actually found, after an initial spike in it, we were actually able to get people self-identifying, and the awareness actually helped us treat concussions better, identifying people better. And we've been able to make youth sports much better. So I think awareness always takes a little bit of time to settle out, but overall, I'm always going to agree it's a good thing. Is there such a thing as good anxiety versus bad anxiety? Again, I think the term has become so overladen that it's hard to separate out, but these are things that we're discussing in the medical community also. And so a very key article that just came out a couple of weeks ago in the New England Journal of Medicine, sort of the main article, talked about being well while doing well, distinguishing necessary from unnecessary discomfort in training. And so it's kind of an interesting concept, right? Is there such a thing as necessary discomfort? And
yeah.
I mean, if you're a striver, if you're really trying to accomplish something, it involves pain. If you want to be a long distance runner, I mean, you're going to have to work hard at running and there's going to be some physical discomfort. And if you're a top athlete, you're going to want to ice down or get a massage afterwards to address it. So I'm not sure that all discomfort is bad. I mean, if it's forced, it's bad, but I'm not sure that some people can't embrace the discomfort to get to a goal. And I'm not sure that I'm an evil person by saying that trying to achieve something is that. I mean, I'm a pediatric neurosurgeon. I think I have the greatest job in the world because I get to help people and their families with really severe illnesses and diseases. And I think my team helps save lives. But there was a lot of discomfort getting to this point. You know, there was a lot of time when I worked 100-hour weeks and I still stay up and read and I'm still available on calls. And all of that stuff is uncomfortable, but it's to a greater purpose. And as long as people buy into that greater purpose and they're not doing it for the wrong reasons, I think it's okay.
Yeah, it's so complex. And I agree with you. I would rather us, particularly us as a school, err on the side of destigmatization and make sure that everyone knows there's a place here when they need it. But you're right. Accomplishing hard things requires some discomfort sometimes in building that sense of resilience.
And I think that's a great word. So we want to help people build resilience and we want to actually help them with emotional regulation where they're able to work at something and feel positive about it and not feel anxious or not feel discomfort over that.
You mentioned sort of notions of inclusion and belonging, and you know, some of these things have become political lightning rods, but I think we at Harvard Westlake regard notions of belonging as really essential to creating good mental health for adolescents on our campus. You know, for example, just recently I'm thinking about our families who have relatives in the Middle East right now and how hard this period has been for those students. How important is it in your mind for students, especially those with differences of identity in the way of religion, race, gender, sexual orientation, those with learning differences, which is a big area of focus, increased area of focus at Harvard Westlake. How important is it for students to feel like they belong at school?
Yeah, and I think that that's, you know, the best thing that the school could do is make people feel that they're a part of the team. I mean, look, from time immemorial, kids have always felt when they're adolescents that they're behind other kids or they're not part of the in-group or anything like that. You know, if you ask, you know, most people, one of their most difficult, you know, years of life is like seventh and eighth grade when they feel that everybody else is somewhat different than them and they're comparing themselves for all the things we talked about earlier to other kids and trying to see where they fit in. And so I think the key thing is to provide different opportunities for people to fit in. And what we've done at our hospital is we've done two things. One is we've formed employee related groups so people can have people who have similarities and they can seek them out and they can feel connected to them. But we've also done cross group things. So my department has something called Ubuntu Family Dinners, where we're actually able to bring different types of people together. Picture this as you will, but we had 20 surgeons doing a sound bath the other night. You know, that was used to break down social barriers and get people to talk about all different sorts of things. And I think getting people to feel part of a group is important, but also getting to feel that they could interact with people who they would never interact with before is important also. And I think that that's, you know, some great work that the school can do.
And so back to the parenting question, I mean, this is super tricky as well. There's no easy answers around these things. As parents, you know, I've heard the advice that we need to, in this, you know, as long as we're taking the phones away, stay engaged, stay curious about our children's interests in order to demonstrate that we care. There's also the flip side of that, the phenomenon of helicopter parenting, which is when the engagement goes too far and kids feel a sense that they're being kind of suffocated by a parent who is overly engaged. How do we strike that balance as parents?
Yeah, it's a hard one, right? And I don't know that anyone does this perfectly. And I definitely don't do this perfectly. I think the concept is availability, right? And trust. So you want your, you know, child to know that they can come to you when they need you. And you want them to know that you're going to give them your best answer on these things and judge as little as possible and project your own goals into them as little as possible. But you can't force it. And so, you know, one of the good bits of advice I got from a mentor is he told me that he used to try to drive his kids to school once a week, and that 90% of the time they would just not be talking at all and it would be a little bit demoralizing. But the 10% of the time when they had a conversation was really transformative and all that. So I try to drive Sam to school a fair amount when I can. I mean, as a surgeon, your day usually starts at 6:30, so it's sometimes hard to do that. But the idea is you have to be prepared to listen to some music that you wouldn't otherwise listen to most of the time. But every once in a while, there's an important and meaningful conversation. So I think as a parent, you have to show up and be open and non-judgmental. But you also have to trust the system. And, you know, the community is the school. And you have to feel confident that the school is making a place of community for them as well.
Is there a particular challenge around high-achieving parents? I mean, you mentioned your own story and being a pediatric neurosurgeon, how hard that took, and going through a traditional educational, rigorous educational path. Is that an additional challenge for Harvard-Westlake parents, maybe, who have taken similar, not the exact same, but similarly challenging paths, and then when their child veers from that path a little bit or tries things that a more traditional-minded parent wouldn't understand, is it harder for a parent like that to sort of get their arms around a kid who might just be a little different?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. You know, you can't put your goals into your kid, right? So like the classic example is a dad who was a bad baseball player, but their son has some baseball potential and they're living vicariously through their kid, right? So you don't want to be that person. But I think what you do want to do is you do want to let your child know what your family values are. And very clearly, Christy and my stories are very much based on the fact that we worked really hard. And that's how we've gotten to where we are, that we're ethical and we haven't cheated or cut corners, but we've worked really hard and we would hope Sam would understand that. But in terms of the specifics of it, you have to lead it to themselves. And so I think Sam sort of solved that on his own. You know, he said he's definitely not becoming a doctor and he's not going to become an entertainment executive. And so I think he got the message about hard work and I think he wants to be successful, but I think he recognizes that it'll be in a different area. One of my friends who's, you know, I think this was a really telling exchange, who's a great person and a great father, but he said, you know, his kid said to him, I want to be more successful than you and happier than you. And so, you know, it's a little bit of a stop and take your breath moment. But I think you want to impart what your family values are to your child. You just don't want to dictate a path of action to them. And then I think, you know, similarly importantly, you want their friends to look at you as a resource and you want to be as a resource to their friends also so that you could create a community around them also.
And what about that partnership with the school? You know, this is something we're thinking a lot about as well. And you've mentioned that schools can be part of the solution here, really, not the problem. You know, creating these centers of community and belonging that were absent for so much of the pandemic. But then you have this relationship. It's you and Christy and your son, but then you also have a dean, a teacher, an administrator with whom you're in contact. And how should that relationship work?
Yeah. I mean, I remember when Sam started like his toddler program, you know, a long time ago. And it was really
You're speaking my language now.
Yes, with a two-year-old. But yeah. One of the best Revita Bowers was in charge, and she gave this speech about how when your child starts here, you're entrusting us with the care of your child. And I think that that's sort of a little bit of the key point. You know, when your child goes to a school, it's important for the school to say what their values are. You don't want to go to a school that doesn't have the same values that you do, but you do have to entrust your child into the care of the school. And you have to expect and respect the values of the school to be having a large role. And I think parents could help the school understand where the values should be. I think that the parents could help the school identify gaps. You know, I think that there's a good role for partnership. And I think any communication between the dean and the parents to make sure that the parents and the dean are on the same page about their child is important. But it's important for kids to have a separate community that's not necessarily family-based also. I firmly believe that.
Dr. Krieger, is there anything else occurring at CHLA that we haven't covered? We talked a lot about social media and many of things that I know are top of mind at your hospital. Is there something we haven't covered that you think is also key to understanding, maybe we don't want to call it a crisis, but the phenomenon of adolescent mental health?
Yeah, I think the LGBTQX community is super important to focus on. And so we have a very large program, you know, a trans youth program, but it really now pervades, you know, our whole approach to adolescence. You know, most kids through adolescence in some way or another feel that they are different or don't belong. And it's important to really help children actualize themselves and get the appropriate support so that they do feel that they belong. I just think through all of this and all of the things that I've read, it's a sense of belonging that differentiates kids who make it through okay versus those who have spiraling anxiety. It's hard. There's no one-size-fits-all model for any of this. And so we're trying to support kids, you know, from a mental health point of view in that regard. We do screening for mental health issues here, and we hope we're providing the appropriate support. But it's a very much of a moving target, and we're working really hard at that.
And so many issues around the LGBTQ plus community are new to so many parents too. And so there's a lack of understanding, and maybe places like CHLA can help to increase that understanding among parents. And so that might also lead to a sense of confusion or even skepticism with some parents about what these things are.
Yeah. And again, you know, a partnership with the parents and the child is super important. But, you know, we definitely know that a school that teaches inclusivity and support and trains kids to be upstanders, and a school that trains kids to be able to regulate their emotions, is going to result in a happier student body.
Well, Dr. Krieger, when we, you know, we always end with a few get to know you questions. We did when we had this conversation a few years ago. And so we're going to slightly alter it this time around, since we've already heard about your favorite. So I'm going to spin it slightly and say, LA is known for our movies, our food, and our climate. And so this is probably an easy one, but what's the best movie you've seen recently?
Oh, that's a great easy one. So it's definitely Maestro, which my wife produced.
Shocker.
Yeah. You know, it's a twofold thing. One is, I think it's a super nuanced movie that really does get to a lot of issues about a great person functioning in the world and, you know, how life becomes a part of it. So I think the theme is very interesting and very complicated. But also, my wife has been working on that for about 5 years. And so I've been there, you know, seeing parts of it throughout time. And so to see it come to fruition and to be nominated for an Academy Award has been really, really great. And we had dinner last night with one of her co-producers on the movie. And of course, this was embarrassing to my wife and will be more embarrassing when she hears this. But he, you know, gave a pretty long speech about the grace with which she handled the whole process and how inclusive she was and how she made everybody sort of feel a part of it at all levels was really, really great. So that was really great to hear. So very much proud of her for going through that.
I guess that begs the question, what have you learned from her about how to, I mean, you run a large operations where you've got to think about inclusion and think about how you treat people, treat doctors who are a you know, unique group of very talented, smart, I'm sure stubborn individuals in many ways. What have you learned from Christy and how she handles a film set?
Christy has this incredible gift of directly connecting with people. You know, she remembers people's names and she looks them in the eye, but she gets to really know them. And she really is able to figure out how to support people as best as possible. So it's sort of this individual connection, you know, that's important. When I'm doing surgery, there might be 10 people in a room and I'm focused on the goal, which is, you know, getting the child safely through surgery. But you know, those other 10 people are on the same goal. Like their roles are as important as my roles and they take it as seriously as I am, but they look to me as a leader. And if I connect with them and support them in their mission, that's super important. If I don't make them feel a part of the team, then everything goes really bad. And so I think it's this direct connection and, you know, community that's the most important thing. I know I've said that multiple times to this, but I really do think that that's, you know, the key point of all this.
What's the best meal you've had recently?
I'm going to do the same thing and say it was last night's dinner. it was at a really good restaurant and the food was really good. But it was this discussion about, it was people that we really like, but also had worked with Christy on this movie, and just sort of hearing, you know, the affirmation about how she created a community on this set and supported people really resonated.
And where was the dinner?
It was at a restaurant in Beverly Hills called Funky. And it was really good Italian food.
Is that an Italian restaurant? Yeah.
Yeah. So the food was good, but it was really the conversation, which was much more affirming.
Usually the third question is, what's your favorite place in LA? I guess when you and your wife are amid on this theme, amid this sort of Oscar race and going to these different, was there a particular moment during this Oscar race or award show season that was, aside from last night, that was either a pinch me moment or a unique experience that you got to have?
Yeah, I'm getting better at cherishing my direct connections with people. And so the fact that when I go to these big events, the fact that there are people that I really like talking to who I could sort of pair off is sort of the main thing for me. So I'm less taken with the extravagance of the whole thing and the overall scene and more with the individual connections. And so, you know, it's all about feeling included with people, right? And if you feel that people accept you for who you are and are not looking at you in a different way or evaluating that, you know, I think that's important. And I really feel that we've reached a place where we could be who we are, even in those circumstances, which I think is incredibly valuable and really a gift.
So even though there are celebrities around and you're a mid-award show, you know, A, you guys have been doing this a long time, but also you have some real genuine relationships.
Yeah, and some of them are famous people and some of them are not famous people. But right. I think the gift that we have due to Christie's success is we're able to be genuine with the people that we're with, and we're able to spend time with the people that we love spending time with. And I think that that's really a gift. And, you know, I'll also say that being able to come to work in the hospital, and I did big operations yesterday and then went to this dinner. So I think that having that combination of things is really a blessing.
I can't think of something more grounding than coming from a surgery like that. Into a dinner.
Yeah. And then, you know, I get to go to work the next day and deal with people doing well or complications and that sort of thing. So there is a nice objective outcome of what we do. You know, I had this conversation with Sam the other day that most adolescents, as they should, look at the world as being a meritocracy, right? Like if they do things well, they will succeed. And I think that you could talk about Catcher in the Rye and things of that sort. But the world, oftentimes, there's other things going on, as we talked about, and divisiveness and things that aren't as meritocratic. And I think one of the things that I love about my job is there's an objective reality to it. And, you know, we deal with kids who are sick and we make them better. And I think that that's very affirming to me.
Last question is always around parenting advice. And for those who are, my daughters now are 5 and 2.5. And your son, as you mentioned, is in 9th grade. Any, just over the last few years, things you've learned about parenting or advice that you could impart to me, particularly in this age of concern around mental health, but maybe not, maybe in general, any parenting advice for me?
Yeah, I think the key thing I used to think, and maybe I said this even last time, but you know, in the whole nature versus nurture debate, right? Like I used to think when I saw a kid, the way that that kid acted, for better or worse, was due to parenting. And I think what I've learned, especially as being a parent, is that kids sort of come out with a certain predisposition to certain ways. And the best thing that you can do as a parent is understand who they are and try to affirm them for who they are. I mean, you're going to try to tweak them and move them in different directions and stuff. But you'll see with 2 kids, they're going to have the same genetic makeup, but they're going to act very differently and respond very differently. And so I think knowing your kid and not forcing a construct onto them is the most important way of doing it. And as we've talked about, I mean, Harvard-Westlake is great for some people. And if you know your kid and they go there and it's the right place for them, it's great. But the parents who put things onto their kids that aren't consistent with who the kids are is that. So I think it's more of a listening type of thing. And I would have to say in my job, the thing that I've learned to do over time is just to listen a lot more and not try to jump forward with solutions. I'm still not good at that. And Sam would definitely tell you that. But
Dr. Krieger, thank you for joining us again. The first ever return guest on the supporting cast. And I guess I hope we don't have another public health crisis to talk through, but I always love talking to you and would be happily do it again.
I love talking to you too. I appreciate all the work that you're doing. And this was fun. So hopefully it's helpful.
Thanks for joining the supporting cast.
All right. Take care.